Hey, very good afternoon, everybody, here at the beautiful Pasadena Victory Park. It is Sunday, 25th of February, 2024, and a beautiful leap year. I just figured that out yesterday. Now, I'm going to very quickly, like we always do, introduce people's rights to the newbies and obviously the recording, just in case you don't know what people's rights is all about. Okay, well, let's break it down word by word. People, well, we're people. We're not animals. We're not plants. We're not trash cans. We're people with feelings and, you know, rights, which is our next word, rights. So the whole point of people's rights was set up to, first of all, not only know your rights, but also to protect and defend your rights of your neighbors, your friends, anyone out there. Now, the rights that we enjoy in society, it took a long time for our rights to be established. So, you know, why on earth would anyone let their rights be trampled on and just trashed in an instant, when really, you know, you want to be able to defend them for yourself and your neighbor? So I suppose if it was a three, you know, few step process, zero step would be to know what your rights are and the law and so forth. That'll be the zeroth step. The first step would be willing and able if a family member or a friend was rights were violated, and that could mean a lot of different things. It could be from you know, law enforcement. It could be from an elected official, unelected official, your boss, friend, anyone. You've got to be willing and able to help defend the rights of yourself or your friends or your family. And I guess step two would therefore obviously be you actually follow through and you get the call to say that, hey, someone's rights are being violated. You show up for that person and you put pressure on that organization or that agency or that person to say, hey, man, or hey, woman, you can't do that. So anyway, that's just a quick rundown of us, what we do every week. Now, I'm very excited to bring Deb to the stage, Deb Baber. She's a wonderful woman. I've known her for quite a few years now. I'd say at least three, probably four. During the scamdemic, we were working pretty close beside each other, upholding the rights of businesses, actually, mostly small businesses, because we all know that Walmart, Target, and all these big corporations were allowed to stay open, whereas the small mom and pop stores, they were told, oh, you got to close. Well, why is it? They're selling identical stuff. So it's a perfect little segue in from people's rights into Deb. Deb's going for District 38. That's in Western Ventura County. She's a lovely, upstanding woman. She's all about smaller governments, what the government can and cannot do, like the overreaching governments and like stopping them and basically doing the right thing. You know, their kids are being indoctrinated, we're being indoctrinated, and governments are getting a bit too big and out of control. And at the end of the day, the government works for us. The governments are, technically speaking, are our servants, not the other way around. They're going to have you trying to believe that we're their servants. No way. No way. So without further ado, I want to give a warm welcome to Deb on the stage, and let's do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ash. I appreciate that very much. Ash and I went through a few fires before we got to the ashes. And the picture that you will see on the handout that's here that gives you a little more information about me, that picture, Brave, businesses representing American values and enterprises. That's how we first got to know each other. And it's what was established there in Ventura County when we were trying to push back against the government. And I was going to actually start speaking about something else, but because of what Ash was talking about in terms of our rights, what this group is all about, let me begin at the beginning, the very beginning that we need. And that is that if we don't know what our rights are, we don't have any. And the right of government in this nation, the American system of government, which makes it unique among all governments in the world throughout history, is that we the people, men and women, create government that we allow to govern by our consent. And when they are no longer governing with our consent, then we have an obligation to get rid of them. part of what our country did is to establish in words, and words become incredibly important. So they put into words the kinds of things that we needed as kind of a structure for us to operate a brand new country. And so with that, I would introduce to you something called the Elementary Catechism of the Constitution of the United States. I have these for sale. They're at my cost. What this is, it's a replica from 1828. It was written by a teacher who in 1828 wanted to teach his students about the United States and its Constitution. And so what he did is he developed a book, a booklet, of over 300 questions and answers. And one of the things that's really quite brilliant about this is that you can open it up on any page, read any question, read the answer, and consider what that means in your life. If you have children, it's a great exercise at the dinner table to ask your child or children to open it up, read a question, read the answer, and then have a conversation. It's a great tool for learning the Constitution quickly and its essence. And if you stop to think about it, in 1828, the Constitution was barely 40 years old, our country barely 50 years old. So the very first question in this book is, in what country do you live? And when I share this with young people and I ask them to read that first question, and they're so surprised, but once again, 40 years after the Constitution was formed and 50 years after the nation, that's barely two generations, many people in this country spoke different languages when they went home, had different cultures when they went home, or had just emigrated to these United States. So it becomes really important to define who we are. What are our boundaries? We are the United States of the United States of America. So there, at any rate, it's a great little tool. In addition to it, I've looked at a number of books for research. Part of what I've been trying to do for the last several years has been trying to find a way to kind of develop a set of cliff notes for getting people up to speed in a hurry on what our rights are and our obligations so that we can take action in a more meaningful way and that we're not just complaining about it. And that we are directing our energies in such a way that we don't dissipate them and become discouraged. I'd like to say that, you know, everybody's an armchair politician, but few people are armchair cardiologists. They just aren't, right? But everybody's an armchair politician. So this book, the Know Your Bill of Rights book, one of the reasons I really like this is it takes the first 10 amendments, which is our Bill of Rights, which, by the way, the Constitution would not have passed if the Bill of Rights had not been introduced. The Constitution was done, and it started to get some attention, and there were a couple of states that said, it's not enough. We need to know what is allowed, what government is allowed to do, and what they're not allowed to do. And so the Bill of Rights came into existence, the first 10 amendments. So in this book, part of what he does is he takes each of those first of the 10 amendments and he lists it and then he describes the essence of those things and he gives you a vocabulary for that amendment. And when you start to learn the words that are associated with that amendment, you start to connect the dots in your mind so that when you're talking about a particular right, you may be able to immediately invoke one of the amendments to be able to sustain what it is that you're talking about in terms of argument. So I have this available as well. In addition, I like to say I'm not a conservative. I'm a constitutionalist. And I have found in the last several years that it's become really important to be precise in our language when we talk about politics. And so I'm a constitutionalist because the word conservative has been changed and means different things to different people depending on their frame of reference. It's like I could say to you, I'm gay, Mark, my husband, I'm gay. Yes, exactly. And we all know that word gay, where that has the journey that that word has taken in many, these last two, almost 200 years. And so I'm a constitutionalist, and I'm not a Republican in the current incarnation. Instead, I define myself as an original Republican. And what do I mean by that? It is, I'm a Republican hearkening back to the 1860 platform that established the Republican Party in the United States. This platform in 1860 is what put Lincoln in the White House. This platform is a single page. I don't remember. I think it's maybe got 800 words or something like that on it. Versus the current Republican platform, which is, I don't know, 24, 28 pages now and thousands of words. And what I decided to do was go back and take a look at this. So if you've never read the 1860 platform that established the Republican Party, they named themselves Republican after the American Republic, not a democracy. Then you pull out the principles founded in this 1860 document. And these you can have for free. I've got a bunch of them up here, and you're welcome to take them. Because if you've never read it, I encourage you to read it. If you have read it but haven't read it recently, I encourage you to read it again. And to, again, focus on the principles that are here. There are some sections of it that if you take out any dates or other identifying time frames that are in the words, you will say, gosh, this could have been written and published in the newspaper yesterday when it discusses about the opposition. So I have this available to you as well. And with that, I want to ask, is anybody else here running for office? Anybody else? Central Committee? Any of those things? Okay.
I've got a friend who is.
A friend who's running for office. So why am I running for office? It's a good question. So I'm running because I do believe this is the year that we must take back our governments at all levels. I believe, if I were to ask you, do you believe that the current administration, the Biden administration, is affecting your daily lives?
Absolutely.
Yes.
In a negative way.
So you believe that. Part of the reason for that is because our Constitution and our founding documents and the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers were arguments about having a single massive governing body, the federal government, versus the sovereign states that govern over sovereign individuals, sovereign men and women. So we sovereign men and women live in a sovereign state, in a sovereign nation. But what has happened over the last 150 years or so is the consolidation of power in Washington, D.C., and our government was set up to precisely avoid that kind of accumulation of power. And so one of the things in, if you think about it, communist nations, socialist nations, there are very few places that they have elections where the person that's running gets 98% of the vote, 99% of the vote, except in nations that are socialist communist nations. Then they get 95% of the vote or what have you. So I would point out that Joe Biden got 98% of the vote in South Carolina. He was the only one on the ballot, 98%. But the important piece about that is that history will record it as he got 98% of the vote. And so we need to be mindful of why freedom of speech is so important and why it's in that First Amendment, is because whoever writes the history is the winner, and we need to be winners. So consolidating power into the federal government, and we are feeling the effects of that massively because of that consolidation, controlling things through money. The federal government takes a ton of taxes. Our state government takes a ton of taxes. Local governments take a ton of taxes. School districts create a ton of taxes. All of that said, that it's a formation of something called democratic centralism. If that's not a term familiar with you, then I offer it to you to research. Democratic centralism is a term that was developed to describe the Soviet Union's structure of government, whereby they sold to the people a democratic concept, centralized in a group of people, the Politburo. And basically what was said is that, yes, you have democracy here, because while you don't get to elect who goes to the Politburo, those people do have a democratic process to determine what's going to happen to the rest of the country out of the Politburo. But now you have a collection of people that are going to be influenced by Stalin, Lenin, whoever's the head, and they're not going to be speaking up about a problem. We can guarantee that. But that's democratic centralism, which is what we have that's been created in our country. So one of the reasons that I'm running and that I got into the race is because I believe that if Donald Trump is not back in the White House, that if our nation is not completely finished, it will be holding on to bare threads of existence as an American republic, a constitutional republic. So part of the reason for me getting into a statewide contest is because it carries visibility. It means that I can be out there on the campaign trail and I campaign with Donald Trump and Agenda 47 as part of my central calling card, because I believe that the principles that you find in Agenda 47, Donald Trump's agenda for the White House, that when you find the principles in there, that turned into policies in any district in California will deliver dreams into destiny. So Agenda 47 principles put into policies in the districts in California state will turn dreams into destiny. And so what we have here, I got together with a couple of people to form California MAGA. And this formed in the spring, about March. And our whole purpose for existing is Agenda 47, is to educate people about Agenda 47. And what you have, and these are also free, is two things. You have 15 items that we need to correct in our country, listed here on the insert. This is a sample of Agenda 47 that gives you the solutions. I've been following Donald Trump since 1979. I lived in New York City for over 34 years. I started following him when I first moved there. He's the real deal. There is so much effort being made to create lies about Donald Trump because he and his family don't even have parking tickets. They must go after him with lies because there is nothing there to otherwise attack him with. Donald Trump was raised in a household where his German father, from his grandfather was from Germany, where his German father had a work ethic that said to Donald Trump and his siblings, his four siblings, you've got to work hard for what you're going to earn in your life. And because one day you're going to be in control of people that are laying bricks, because we're in that industry, you need to know how to lay bricks yourself. So Fred Trump brought the children up knowing that they had to work hard and showing them how to lay bricks. Donald Trump brought his children up, at least the older three, and his task for them was, you have to learn how to drive a heavy piece of machinery. And Ivanka Trump, there's an article, I think, in the Atlantic magazine, a picture of Ivanka Trump teaching her daughter how to drive a backhoe. So they're passing along that notion in the family. The other part of that is so important, Donald Trump's mother was from Scotland, from the Hebrides Islands. And she brought with her an ethos that says, if you are born into some kind of blessing, in this case, wealth for Donald Trump, if you're born into some kind of blessing, you have a responsibility to deliver back to your community. And she said, I'm proud of the name Trump. I'm proud that Trump is on this building. It's on the hotel. It's on the auditorium over there. It's on the apartment house. But I better never see the Trump name above the wing of a hospital or the pavilion of a museum. She said, I don't want anybody to walk under the name Trump and think they owe this family anything, because they don't. You owe the family. You owe the people, because you have been given something. You were born into this blessing, and you owe back. And what really brings that home is a story from last spring. I've been wearing Trump gear since the fall of 2015, nearly every single day. My husband and I have it on our cars, we have it on our house, we have it on our boat. And again, I wear it almost every single day. I have never had a problem. In addition to that, it wants you. Agenda 47 wants you. So last spring, my husband wanted to get a new Jeep. And so we agreed that I would take his older Jeep and he would get a new Jeep. So now we're at the dealer, at the Jeep dealer, and we're talking with the guy filling out the paperwork. And he says, he looks up and he goes, He said, you know, I used to play ball with Donald Trump. Now remember, that conversation would never have happened except I'm wearing Trump gear. I said, oh, really, Ira? Yes. Oh, yes, yes. I grew up in one of the developments that Fred Trump built in Brooklyn. Oh, really? Ira went on. Yes, Donald Trump is about 10 years older than I am. And he used to go to the development with his dad. And he would get there, and I was about 10, and he was about 8, or I was 8, and he was about 18. And he would play ball with us kids. So I used to play ball with Donald Trump. He said also, Fred Trump took a look at the demographics of who was actually living in this development. And he discovered that who was living in the development was a lot of families with a lot of young children. And that the ratio of parking spaces to parks was not adequate. So he tore out parking lots and put in parks and ball fields for the children in this housing development. And this man, Ira, said, our whole time growing up, our families never had to pay for uniforms or equipment or anything for the ball fields, because it was all paid for by the Trump family. And that's a story you'll never hear from anybody else. And it's a story I never would have heard except that I was wearing Trump gear, and Ira knew he could share that story with me. And now I share it with you. So there's nothing there. In fact, I used to look at, after all of this started with Donald Trump out there, I used to look at the page 6 in New York City. Page 6 is a scandal sheet of the New York Post. And there would be, it would announce, you know, that this child, this celebrity's child, or this celebrity is on drugs, this one's having an affair, this one's doing that, this one's doing whatever. Terrible things. And down when Donald Trump Jr. got old enough to appear on these scandal sheets, down in the lower right-hand corner, there would be like a footnote, and Donald Trump Jr. was seen dating a new woman. That was it. No drugs, no alcohol, no theft, nothing. And I offer this as an observation for those of you who still are on the fence about Donald Trump or what kind of personality he is, and to also illustrate the penetration of the narrative when you don't own the mainstream media narrative. And it's this. One of the exports from the United States has been entertainment. Our entertainment capital, we're very close to it right here in Pasadena. So if we think about that and we think about New York City, most people have an opinion about New York City. And if they have an opinion about New York City and they think a little bit more deeply about it, they might think about Manhattan. And if they think about Manhattan's personality, they might think of Sex and the City. And if they think about the Bronx and its personality, they might think about Goodfellas or the Mafia. And if we're looking at Brooklyn, they might think about some show that's about up-and-coming yuppies or something. And maybe in Staten Island, maybe it's Blue Bloods. What are the entertainment series associated with Queens, New York? All in the Family, Archie Bunker the Bigot, and the King of Queens, also a bigot blue-collar worker. So what happened when Donald Trump came down that escalator, and I saw him coming down that escalator with his beautiful wife, Melania, and they're coming on down, and I'm looking, and I'm thinking, wow, this is going to be a great announcement coming on out. Here we go. If you first met me and heard me speaking that way, you would assume a lot of things about my values and about where I come from. And I realized when Donald Trump came down that escalator, because I lived in Queens for 7 years before moving into Manhattan, that he was a Queens boy with Queens mannerisms and a cadence to his voice that was directly Queens, and that he would be grossly misunderstood just from his presentation. He's a scrapper from Queens, and that is the personality they have. In fact, in New York City, Queens was often considered kind of the armpit borough of all the others. So even in New York City, it was not viewed kindly. And when Donald Trump made his way out of Queens into Manhattan, he was resented by all of the old money and the establishment because he didn't need any of them at all. And that is why he is so fiercely, so people are so afraid of him today, is because he does not need the political establishment. He doesn't want the political establishment. And he doesn't need their money. And if any of you saw the town hall recently with Laura Ingraham, and the question was asked, don't you sometimes just want to stop? Don't you just want to, you know, this is so hard on you, the family. Don't you just want to quit? And Donald Trump's answer, I can't quit. What do you mean you can't quit? I can't quit. There's a job to do. I have a responsibility. And then later in that same broadcast, a woman asks, basically, says, well, they say that you're out for revenge. Are you out for revenge? What's Donald Trump's answer? Success will be my revenge. Success will be our revenge. And that is how the man gets up in the morning, has a smile on his face, can be funny as all get out, and can think clearly about how to dispense with the deep state. There's one other feature I want to share with you that about Donald Trump, and then I'll tell you why my campaign advertises Agenda 47 and why I'm campaigning with Trump at the forefront of my campaign, aside from everything else I've mentioned. And that is something called Project 2025. Has anybody heard of Project 2025? I don't really see any hands. So Project 2025, I want you to be on the lookout as you look at groups of people that are getting together to protest Donald Trump or any of those kinds of things, and start looking to see if you see signs that are protesting Project 2025. I'm starting to see them develop. And what is Project 2025? Project 2025 is headed up by Donald Trump's former HR guy for the federal government. He is partnered with a number of conservative institutions like the Heritage Foundation. And what they have done is they've put together a fairly extensive application so that if you want to work in a Trump administration, you need to apply now because they're vetting all of the people. They want to make sure that when they get back into the White House, that they can hit the ground running. And the way Kash Patel describes it, when Donald Trump takes his hand off the Bible in January of 2025, moments later, there will be thousands of federal employees that will get pink slips and several hundred federal employees that will start their jobs. But here's the beauty of Project 2025. You don't go to Washington. You do it right where you are. You bust up the administrative state in one fell swoop by dismissing a whole host of unnecessary personnel, unelected bureaucrats that have been trying to govern through their influence over the administrative state, and instead you push it back to the states and to the people in the states. Now, if a lobbyist wants to lobby for something, they no longer can go to go to Main Street or K Street in Washington, D.C. and see all the people that they need to see in one day. But but they'll have to go to a dozen different places in the United States. So this is part of the plan to break up the deep state, the administrative state that has grown up in this country. So with that, people are not going to know the name Baber. Some people do. Ash does. But they know the name Donald Trump. And importantly, when people vote for me, they're going to know what they're going to get. And so I think that's important too. And whether or not you agree with everything that Donald Trump does, I don't necessarily agree with everything that he does or says any either. But we must learn to govern alongside each other, not despite each other. And if you've never read The Art of the Deal, copies of which I have here if you're interested, I encourage you to read it because you will understand how Donald Trump operates if you read The Art of the Deal. It does the same thing in terms of business as he does for the government, which means that you can't leave somebody or some entity or some group feeling like they have been defeated, except for really, really, really bad people. But you can't leave people feeling like somehow they are left on the outside. That is how too many of us are feeling right now. And instead, you must find a way to govern alongside each other, which is how our Constitution and our founding documents were written, was it's to allow for the greatest number of people with a variety of ideas, personalities, and cultures to come together and agree to some governing principles for or governing mechanisms for the public interactions. And so I'm out there with Donald Trump because when people see my signage, they will see Trump, and they will come over to either talk to me because they're happy to see it, or maybe talk to me because they're not happy to see it. Either way, I welcome the conversation. And I can tell you, I was telling Jane earlier, if somebody wearing this Trump gear, if somebody comes up to me and starts talking about what I've got on and they're very aggressive and how dare you, don't you know, and so on, well, I know immediately it's a great tool for immediately understanding that's somebody who's not well. It is not normal to go up to a human being and start yelling at them about the clothes that they are wearing. It would be like going up to somebody who's got on a Jack Daniel's shirt and saying, don't you know how alcoholism kills? What are you doing wearing that shirt? It's the same thing. So it's not normal. And so I know I need to disengage with that individual. And there's a story about that. So a couple of years ago before COVID in 2019, the last time before this last year when they had the state, the county fair again in Ventura. So in 2019, before it was closed for because of COVID, there was a man who had a great handlebar mustache, and I was at the Republican booth, and Donald Trump was all over the booth because I decorated the booth. Donald Trump was all over the booth, and he comes over, and he's fierce, and he's like, starts in on me, Donald Trump this and Donald Trump that, and I said, you know something? We're going to have to agree to disagree, but can we at least agree you've got a great mustache, great mustache? Well, he didn't want to hear that. No, he just wanted to go on about it. I said, I know, but we're going to have to agree to disagree. You've got a great mustache. Can we agree on that? You've got a great mustache. How long does it take you to do that mustache? I tried to engage him in something that clearly he spent time with, important to him, a feature of his personality. He finally got frustrated and walked away. Okay, fast forward to last summer. For the first time, the county fair is open again. I'm at the Republican booth. Donald Trump is up there. Some guy comes up and starts in on me. And I said, oh, I know you. You're the guy with that great mustache. And he looked and he turned away. So he had not changed his mind about Donald Trump. But he knew that there was no point in engaging with me about Donald Trump. But so that was kind of a full circle, the way that came to. So a couple of things that I wanted to mention about tools to help you understand who to vote for, because down here, you can't vote for me, obviously, but you can support me. If you're interested, you can go to my website, and I can give you lists to make phone calls to people. You can send emails to people, and I'll give you all the tools that you need. If you want to just do 10 of them and see how you feel about it, just let me know, and I'm happy to do that, happy to send you that list. In addition to that, you can contribute. Now, money, it's kind of hard to find where to support me financially on my website. It's because I don't want money to be forefront in people's minds. Although you need money to do things, everything that we're printing costs something. But let's go to what the essence of money is. And the essence of money is your elbow grease. It's your resource. There's only one resource in the world. It's a human resource. There are no other resources, just us, men and women, human resource. And what you do that gets you some kind of currency, something of value that you can then trade with others, is the essence of who you is your essence that you're putting out there. You're putting your, I'll give you some of my essence for that thing that you made with your essence. And so that it's that kind of exchange. And that's why money has such power over us, is because it's basically capturing the human resource. So if you capture the essence, the value, you have captured and enslaved the individuals. And so I don't want my campaign to be focused on the money. But when people look at the campaign and evaluate it, they do look at money, and you'll hear that, right? They raise so many millions of dollars, so many whatever dollars. Something else that they look at, though, is the number of contributions. So, and somebody asked me the question the other day, well, how do you know small contributions? Because anything less than $99 at the assembly race does not have to be reported in detail, and that's cumulative. That means if somebody gives me $50 today, it doesn't have to be reported in detail. If they give me $50 tomorrow, that's $100. We broke the 99 cumulative, so now we have to report them. I have to report them as an individual. Anything under $99 does not have to get reported at that detail. So now what you do is you take the total amount of money that's out there that's been reported with its detail, and if you've got $10 million and you've got 10 people, then you know each of those people gave $1 million, or each of those entities gave $1 million. But if you've got $10 million and you've got three people that are reported and you can see what their contributions were, then you know that the bulk of the contributions that came into there, you take then, let's say, of the three people that they together gave $1 million. Now you've got $9 million and you divide it by the $99, and now you start to get some idea about how many people might have, what was the average, right, campaign contribution. So it's important. So I encourage people, if that's something that you can do, great. $5 is fine. $10 is fine. Nothing is fine. But getting involved is not fine. That becomes essential. And whether it's involvement with my campaign or it's involvement with one of your campaigns for somebody in your area, either way, that becomes important, and there's some tools to give you. What's that? So what this is, and these are free, you're welcome to take it. The Freedom Index is a tool put out by the John Birch Society, or New American is the one that does the Freedom Index. And they started this, I think it was in 2010 when they began this. And what this does is, this is at the federal government, this one that I have here. It evaluates 20 pieces of legislation in a year. They do one issue and then their second issue. So they do 10 pieces of legislation and then 10 pieces of legislation. The only thing it does is it asks the question first, is this piece of legislation constitutional? If it is constitutional and you vote for it, then you get a plus. If it is not constitutional and you vote for it, you get a minus. If you cast no vote, then you get nothing. So this is strictly straight up. It's constitutional, straight down. It's not constitutional. And it lists all of our elected representatives in the House of Representatives and in the Senate. And you're welcome to take copies of these. And then when you get there, You can visit the website for the New American, the Freedom Index, and you can then scroll down and you can choose California because they've done the same thing for the states. So you can look up your representative, your local representative, and remember, they're just judging, are they voting constitutionally or not voting constitutionally? And this will help give you some measure of understanding about how that representative is representing not just you, but holding up their oath to the Constitution. Many of them just don't know. And part of our job is to learn as much as we can as the bosses of our business, which is running our country, and make sure that we start to put people in those spots that know what it is to govern constitutionally. Because I believe that government is too big, it takes too much money out of our pockets, and far too often it governs outside its authority. It's too big. It's too big. California is one of 10 states in the United States that has a full-time legislature. One of 10, only 10. The next two populous states in the United States, Texas and Florida, have part-time legislatures. We Californians do not need a full-time legislator to tell us how to educate our children, manage our health, deal with our finances, or handle our business. We just don't need it. We need a part-time legislature. Part of the difficulty, if you stop to think about it, is that because they have made themselves full-time, we've allowed that over time, that when they get down to it, there's busy work. And if they don't have enough to do, they're going to come up with something so that they can justify to you that they're doing the job that you elected them to do and that they deserve the salary that they're getting. Whereas it's like in school, we all are probably familiar with a teacher who used to give us busy work. And sometimes we'd take it home and our parents would go, "What? The teacher wants you to do what? That just sounds like busy work to me." Well, we have a legislature that does a whole lot of busy work. On average, between two and 3,000 pieces of legislation annually are introduced in the legislature. 2,000 to 3,000 pieces. When you think of the number of days that they actually work up there, so that's 365 days a year, plus you then take out the weekends, and then the holidays, and then you take out the time that they're actually dark, so to speak, so that they can come back and commune with their constituents, and you're talking maybe 200 days. So in two to 3,000 pieces of legislature that they need to think about in some fashion, some form, over a 200-day period. Nobody can do that. It's not possible, which is what gives rise to ever-increasing staff that need to help you distill what the legislation is so that you might be able to respond effectively or intelligently about that legislation. Or maybe you just take their opinion and you just run with it and you never know what's really in the bill. And that leads me to something else. So they're too big. And now, too much money. 15% of the workforce in California is paid with government taxpayer funds. 15% of California's workforce receives a taxpayer-funded paycheck. And what does that mean? It means that you and I, we pay our taxes. And you and I, we pay their salaries. And that means that we pay our taxes and their taxes too. They could not pay their taxes unless they give the taxpayer-funded paycheck that we give them. So 15%, that's $4 billion annually that is paid out in payroll taxes that is on top of the taxes that we pay, but we don't think of it that way because it's embedded in somebody else's paycheck that is paid to them with our tax dollars. So too big, too much, and too often. I don't have to tell this group they're legislating outside their authority when I say COVID, do I? C-19, closing businesses, closing churches, putting tape, yellow tape around children's playgrounds as though it was a homicide. That's not their job. Their job, and I do have it on the back of my flyer, about what government is supposed to do. What is their proper role? Their proper role is only in the public nexus. So, a real quick history, and then I do want to take some questions. How is it that government in our country became such the behemoth that it is? Because most people are good. Most of us really do want the same things. We want to live a good life. We want to love our children. We want them to grow up to be good citizens. And the first 150 years of our nation's founding, we Americans had something in common. Every one of us either went to church every week or we read the Bible or both. Most of us did both. So we had some kind of common denominator from which we drew our values. And those values hearken directly back to the Ten Commandments. And the Ten Commandments, as the Judeo-Christian ethos, if we all lived by the Ten Commandments, we would not need government. If we all lived by the Ten Commandments. So what has happened? So we have this country, and now the Industrial Revolution occurs. And we start to have people drawn to the urban centers. And they're different cultures and all that are going to the urban centers, and they start to clash. So you have the Irish that might be working in the barrel factory, and you have the Swedish that are working in the fabric factory, and they don't really speak the language easily, but they both love America, and they both immigrated here, and they're from those families, but they have some kind of cultural difference in the public sphere because they're transiting to get to their jobs or what have you. And that's when government comes in and says, okay, so to help facilitate this public passage, this public rubbing of shoulders, these are going to be the rules that we're going to work by. And everybody says, yes, that makes sense. That makes sense. But now when you go home to your private places, you do what it is that you want to do. But when you're in the public place, you're not going to spit on the ground because that can carry disease. We now know that. So you're not going to spit on the ground, and you're not going to sleep on public property. And there are a couple of other things. And you're going to wait for the car doors to open if you're in, I'm thinking of the subway in New York. There are different rules like that. And we're going to provide that public transportation. So when you get on it, you're now being governed by the public statutes. So now this comes to illustrate this very clearly. I don't know how many of you have heard of micro kitchens in California. Micro kitchens. So I see a hand here. Micro kitchens in California came to be after COVID. And it was pronounced and declared by Newsom, among others, that it was a great benefit. Oh, look at us. We're going to make this opportunity. We know businesses were hurting, especially restaurant businesses were hurting so bad. And sometimes you may not have the capital to really ramp back up or get your business started. So we're going to give you an opportunity to have a kitchen in your house. And we're going to give you grant money to get you to do that. And what's the problem with that? As soon as you take that money, you have a contract to open up your home, your castle, to the public interest. So if you know anybody who's even thinking about it, discourage them from doing it, because they open up their home to the public interest and invite government inside. And I encourage you, as you look at anything that comes about, to ask yourself, if I agree to this, am I acting, is it constitutional, first of all? And second, if it's not constitutional, or if it is constitutional, do I see any way that this is being framed that it might come into my private existence and therefore give a hook to the government into my private world? So that's why I campaign with Donald Trump at the forefront. And I encourage people to bring their questions. And one last thing. What makes Donald Trump so successful is you can't solve a problem unless you identify it. You have to clearly identify the problem. If you just talk about inner city crime without identifying where the inner city crime is coming from, who's doing the inner city crime, and what their particular origins are, then you can't solve the problem. So Donald Trump, in that handout, 15 things that he has said he needs to do to restore our country, and then the examples of the solutions, which is Agenda 47. And with that, I would love to take some questions.
All right. Thank you, Deb. Appreciate
you. Thank you.
Talking to us. So anybody that does have a question, please come up to this microphone where I'm standing now and ask a brief question and let Deb respond to it. If you have something more extensive you want to say, save it for our open mic period at the end of this talk. So with that having been said, if you have a quick question for Deb, come on up.
Hi, Deb. My name's Travis. I have a question. So you were bringing up the micro kitchens, right? And something immediately popped into my head about it because you were talking about how it invites people, like the government, into your home and, you know, making your home basically public. Has there been any evidence that the government has used that in order to push families to accept the illegal immigrants that they're bringing into this country?
I'm not aware of anything like that. It doesn't mean it's not happening. Part of the difficulty that we have is that there's a lot of media that's out there. And mainstream media is not going to report on anything that's going to be untoward or put the government in a bad light, in California for sure. And even the alternative media, depending on what you're focused on, you may or may not get that information. But certainly I'm on the lookout for, and it's always in my mind when I read about an instance that has happened or a piece of legislation, I ask myself, is there some other plan here? Is there some other mechanism? And I call to your attention, your senator from this area is sponsoring a bill, Senator SB 1160, on firearms. And what is this bill that's now making its way through the legislature? It is a bill that would require any person that owns any firearm to register every single firearm in your home, to register it, and, like your vehicle, pay a property tax annually on that firearm. And the penalty, right, and that property tax, like your cars and so forth, that will be determined on an annual basis. And reportedly, the money collected is going to be to help against gun violence. We're going to get there in a minute, against gun violence. But all of us know that once a lot of money goes into a bucket, how do you really know where it goes from there? How do you hold it accountable from that moment forward? So this would be, I think a penalty that's being talked about is $1,000 per infraction. So if you have three guns and you don't register them and you're found out, that's $3,000. And whatever else they come up with. And that's from the senator in your area. Right? So I just ask you, if I put a gun right here on this table to my left, how many people will it kill?
Zero.
Zero is right. Zero is the correct answer. Because it's not about the gun. It's about the people, and it's about returning to a moral society. So whether or not you believe in God is not important. But what's important is that you believe in a set of values, a set of principles, as in the Ten Commandments, so that you can proceed alongside others and govern together instead of despite each other. Yes.
Well said, Deb. Thank you for the presentation. Very enlightening. I just wanted to know, you say, you know, and I agree that we want smaller governments, smaller officials. I get it, the principle, but how does it translate to the real world? Like, what do you mean? Can we be a bit more specific? Like, who do you throw out? Who do you keep? Just, you know, what does that mean specifically?
It's a good question. So, first of all, if we have a part-time legislature, they don't need full-time staffs. So that's one area that you would start to diminish things immediately. Also, if the money is going for what it's supposed to be doing, road work. Ever notice how only during an election year you start to see road work popping up everywhere And so, and not only that, but you start to see a lot of elected officials showing up at town halls and all talking to people. This is what I'm doing, kind of promoting themselves. And you start to get literature in the mail that is paid for by the Assembly or by the Senate, by their offices and not by their campaigns, but it sure looks like campaign literature. Yeah. So we start to see a lot of that. And so what we need to do is we need to pare government down, and it means it's a tough fight. I mean, putting the genie back in the bottle is not going to be easy. I mean, we didn't get here overnight, for sure. And it's going to be a tough fight, and most people are not going to like it. And you can imagine, and rightfully so, the family that has grown up, and we're on the second or third generation of a government-paid employee, you know, that's going to be a problem. But if that government-paid employee is administering paperwork, and this is a third generation administration of paperwork, they're not out there actually repairing the roads or driving the buses or doing the maintenance, but they're doing paperwork for all of that, we need to take a hard look at it and start dispensing with some of those things. So first of all, we need to identify where is government acting that it should not be acting, and then pursue, as Donald Trump said in his first administration, he said, for every regulation that comes forward, you have to get rid of two. And that philosophy is what we need to go after, is that nothing new, 2,000 pieces of legislation. Here's two things that I would do right away and I would advocate for. One is I would advocate for a cap on the number of pieces of legislation that could make it to the floor. I would advocate for that so that not only would they have to focus on a few pieces of legislation, but we, the governors, the people, would have an opportunity potentially to understand better the 350 or 400 pieces of legislation as opposed to 2,000 or 3,000 to follow them. That's one. The second thing is propositions. Propositions on ballots. Most of those are written by attorneys or CPAs. I would advocate for and push to have it so that every proposition that appeared on the ballot would have to pass the Fleisch-Kincaid reading comprehension test. Fleisch-Kincaid is a tool that has been around for 60-some-odd years, I believe now, used in public schools to determine the level of comprehension of children as they advance in their schooling. So I would work to pass legislation that compelled every proposition to be written at a sixth or seventh grade level of understanding, as determined by an objective source like Fleisch-Kincaid, so that we individually could say, you know what, I'm having a hard time understanding this proposition. I'm going to copy and paste that into a calculator for Fleisch-Kincaid, and you do that and you look, oh, holy cow, this is off the charts. I need to have a PhD to understand that. And to compel the legislation or the propositions so that we could understand them, the majority of people could understand them. Those would be two things I would really press for. So, yes.
Deb, I can't recall myself ever saying this about a political candidate, but I really like you. I really do. And I wanted to say something about the gun issue. Because people that don't understand what the Constitution is about and what the Second Amendment was written for could maybe benefit from you explaining a little bit about that. And I'll just add in a little statistic that very few people know. This comes from the FBI. Guns are used 10 times more often to protect people and stop crime than they are for committing crimes. So I was just wondering if you could comment on the Second Amendment and what it means to you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And yes, I've been endorsed with 100% from the California Rifle and Pistol Association and from the Gun Owners of California. So the Second Amendment, most of us will probably understand that it's meant to for us to protect ourselves with, in this case, firearms, that they cannot be taken away, and that it's that we have a personal, God-given, inalienable right to protect ourselves, to protect our bodies, to protect our property, to protect our families. And if we have opted to use a firearm for that protection, that's our right to do so. And because when we step outside of our four walls, our castles, we're in the public area, and the public area doesn't carry with it safety as a guarantee that for one's ability to be able to carry in the public is also really important and something that should not be diminished in any way. And there was recently, they overturned California's law that said that you couldn't conceal carry in certain areas, and that was just overturned. So hopefully we'll see more of that happen. But it becomes really important. And let's go first again to the essence of everything. And I love this. So I'm going to go back to health for just a moment, which relates to it. Our immune systems are God's checkmate against man's medicine. Our first piece of private property is our body. Our next pieces of private property are our physical surroundings and our family. Those are private. That's private property when they're children. Protecting that becomes essential, and you do it in whatever way you deem appropriate. In the same way that I don't have Jane's immune system, which wouldn't serve me as well as it serves her, and she doesn't have mine, which serves me handsomely. So Jane needs to invest in her immune system. I need to invest in mine. One size doesn't fit all, and that's the same with protecting yourself and your families. I don't advocate that everybody go out and get a gun. That's up to you. Some people are not comfortable with it. I know for many years I was not comfortable handling a gun. It just made me uncomfortable. But I have, in the last 10, 15 years, become very comfortable around firearms. Why? Because you learn how to use them. Because I have an appreciation, a better appreciation, as government has gotten larger, as crime has gotten bigger, I've had a better appreciation for what it means to be able to defend myself and to defend my home. And so for all of those reasons, we need to have the Second Amendment. It needs to be sacrosanct. And one of the things to be on the lookout for is that there are some people advocating for an Article 5 convention, which is a convention of the states. And in a convention of the states, to pass in that amendments to our Constitution that would amend the Second Amendment. So I encourage you, if any of you see anybody talking about we need to have an Article 5 convention so that we can amend the Constitution, think of it this way. Our Constitution is our nation's DNA. What happens when you start to fool around with the DNA? What we see happened here in California on that Proposition 1 that enshrined abortion in ways that it had not been before, and which, a careful reading of it, allows for the infanticide up to 30 days after birth. A careful reading, there's some words in there, that perinatal, I believe is the word, at any rate, that allows for the destruction of that infant up to 30 days after birth. So what history will record is that California embraced abortion. And how do we know that? Because it's in their Constitution. Wasn't enough to put it as a statute where it might be found illegal or others might be able to challenge it. Instead, it's in the Constitution. So when I go to Sacramento and I'll be asked to raise my hand, I haven't figured out how I'm going to handle that piece of it, but I might have I do, with the one exception. And it would be to call that out, because that changed the DNA of California. Yes?
Well, as you know, you and I know each other, and I'm retired military. And I have my focus has primarily been on establishing our actual rights and taking them back. As you know, we're under a feudal system, silent contract, where everybody has signed their rights over to Big Daddy, their government, right? So when it comes down to talking about the constitutional responsibilities in guns, it is written in the Constitution that every able-bodied man is the militia. But being that said, the militia is required to train and be proficient with weapons. Yet Big Daddy is trying to take it away all the time, the parents. The other thing that's going on is when I see the parents being prosecuted for acts that the children committed, or somebody gets killed by an illegal alien because the people let him go or they wrote a law allowing or keeping us from guns. Well, if they're going to prosecute the parents for an action, since the government is Big Daddy, I think all the legislators that approved the removal of guns or prohibitions against our rights should be held criminally liable for whatever actions occurred because they voted for that law that allowed the criminal to do the break the law.
So, John, I agree. Theoretically, it would be great, but we have to complete the circle. They hold those offices at the consent of the people. And as a result, it comes back and it points right back to us, not to them. Because that's been part of the problem that we have
experienced. Well, I'm not seeing it that way, because the same thing with a parent and a child.
Not with a parent and child. So if you think about the family structure, you have to have accountability, and parents need to be their children. They are responsible for their children until they're 18 years old. And historically,
unless they want to change their sex or do anything these other things.
I'm sorry.
Unless they want to change their sex or do anything else, because
you can't change your sex, John. It's impossible.
You know that. So yeah, if they want to configure their body in a different way, and the government is helping them do that. You see,
that's criminal. But that should be the parents reasserting themselves over the rights of their family unit.
But a person can lose their child because they don't allow
understood.
The
community. Understood.
Listen, this is so full of hypocrisy. I just can't stand it. That's another reason I don't want to be a citizen. I want to be a national. I just absolutely refute all these people.
So So you refute all the people that are currently in government, and I guess the question then becomes, are you familiar with any period in time that you would say, that's the government I wish I was living in? That's the era I wish I was living in. I wish I was living in 1790. I wish I was living in 1820. I wish I was living in 1840. I wish I was living in that particular moment. And I ask that question because relative to the governance that was taking place during that period of time versus the governance that's going mm-hmm. on now, to help others understand the differences.
I would say post-World War II. You know, we took the guns to school. They were in our cars. We had gun clubs. We had a civil defense and responsibility for training for emergencies and things like this.
Yes.
And yet the government consistently takes it away based upon us giving them authority to do so when it's a fraud.
Fraud
vitiates everything ab initio.
Of course. But when you say post-World War II, that's the government, that period of time, is it you would say living in? Or prior to that?
Right in that time period where I grew up.
Right.
I was born in 48. I didn't want to change it. But we had a lot more individual ability to do whatever we wanted to do without any interference from our...
Yes, exactly. And I was born in 56, so we're talking about that baby boomer generation, right?
Sure.
So we baby boomers really did enjoy a remarkable landscape. And that remarkable landscape was hard fought for by our ancestors as well as all the others, and then World War I, World War II, and so forth. What happened is that it made us fat. It made us so comfortable. And we were no longer required to get as involved as people before. I have said for decades now.
But I don't see that, because in those days and age, everybody was involved in the local fire station. We were involved in the PTAs.
So what do you think it is that happened then, John?
I think we got complacent and trusted the people that we put in office. We trusted the so-called the way things were.
Great.
And in the meantime, they have suckered us into all of these things, thinking that we're just here to help you.
So again, I agree with you on all of that, but here's where I come out on this. Yes, we became complacent. Why did we become complacent? Let's go to the essence. Essence is really important. The essence is most people are good. If we weren't good, we would have destroyed ourselves a long, long time ago. And since most people are good, we tend to project human, we project onto others our frame of reference. I am not a thief. It would be really hard for me to recognize a thief. In a crowded room, if I wanted to leave my bag somewhere because I needed to run to the restroom, I might set it down to a perfect stranger and say, keep an eye on my bag, please. And I run to the restroom and I come back and the stranger and my bag are gone. And it's because I trusted. It's because my frame of reference is trust. And I did not recognize in that glint of that person's eye that they saw an opportunity. Now, they might have recognized a like thief across the room from them, but I didn't recognize them. And so because we were growing up with such great, we had great opportunity. We had lots of food on the table. We had so many conveniences that were there for us. We had increasing disposable income. We had, as children, we could mow grass. We could deliver papers. We could get a job. We could buy a car. We saved our money and so forth. So we're living life to the fullest. And we're thinking everybody else is doing it too. While we're not paying attention to the few bad apples that are busy consolidating the people, the human resource. And I illustrate it with this. Living in New York City during 9/11, I saw from my conference room a few minutes after the first plane hit the Twin Towers what looked to me like a huge bite out of the side of the first tower. And my brain could not process what I was seeing. It was like I don't know, what's his name? Gorilla, King Kong, had taken this huge bite out of the building. And I kept looking at it. There was no smoke really yet. And it was only maybe 20 minutes later that I understood what had started to happen. So 19 hijackers and their handlers, maybe 100 people in all, changed the way the entire world, over 8 billion people, behave. 100 people. So it becomes really important for us to know ourselves, to know our families, to know each other, that people know when they vote for you who they're voting for and what they're voting for, and that we govern and hold accountable those that we elect. And if we don't do that, then we have what we have today, which is chaos and dysfunction and problems, for sure.
Deb, speaking of chaos and dysfunction, we got a big problem at the moment with misinformation, propagandized news. You know, how are we going to address this? Because, you know, on the same vein you said, you know, you can kill an infant up until 30 days. You know, okay, that's a little bit different where it's snuck in, it's sneaky literature, which is just complex, right? That's a different thing. But you'd have a conversation with someone about that, and they'd say, nah, rubbish. No, that's not true. That's not true. And you get a lot of that. So how can we combat? I mean, do you combat it in conversation? Do you talk about the Smith and Muntz Modernization Act where you can legalize propaganda and print lies? I mean, what do you do? How do your conversations go?
So first of all, I've never gotten my news at any time in my life from television except for right after 9/11 and when we had some severe blackouts in New York.
Oh, by the way, you might want to check your facts on that 9/11 too, but that's a whole different
I understand.
Kettle of fish.
Yeah, there's a lot there, but just on the surface, the what most people know, 19 people, maybe 100 handlers in total, changing the way the world behaved because of the advocacy for fear that then consumed the world in so many ways. But to go to propaganda, so I've been following two news sources for over 15 years. So first of all, I have a consistency with which I can measure what I'm reading and what I'm seeing. I don't get my news from television. I never have in all my life. And what becomes important too is because there are so many conflicting views that are out there, and because your frame of reference, you might absorb a particular item one way and somebody else absorbs it slightly differently. Maybe you had a terrible experience in your life, like somebody tried to kill me when I was 19 with a knife. So I have that experience is in my portfolio. You didn't have that experience, let's say, and you're a man. So however you absorb that, so what you have to do, what we have to do, is we have to really apply our sense, our discernment, common sense. Now, what's a tool that you might be able to do and start to develop that way? So I encourage people to do one thing, to do a couple of things. First, ask yourself, if you had only one of the Ten Commandments that you could adhere to, just one, you have to choose one, which one would it be and why? This is about getting to know who you are. Which Ten Commandment would you choose if you had to choose only one to live by? The answer that I really like is, thou shalt not steal. Now, why is that? Because if you have killed somebody, you've stolen their life. If you are having an affair with somebody else's spouse, you've stolen their future. If you disrespect your parents, you've stolen their honor. So thou shalt not steal. So you look at the Ten Commandments, choose the one, and puzzle through why that one and how would you make that work for all the other things that are there in the world. And here's the second thing that I encourage you to do. If you remember any Bible stories from your childhood, read them again. If you remember them as an adult, or in Aesop's fable, if you remember it as an adult, there's probably something in there today as an adult that will have some meaning to you in your now set of experiences as an adult. And so you just have to discern and guard against the knee-jerk reaction. One thing I would say, and this doesn't always go over really well, but I'm going to say it anyway because I do. It's a joke I made up. So why do women have two X chromosomes and men have an X and a Y chromosome? Because God only took one of Adam's ribs. He just took the X rib. So women have two X chromosomes, and men have an X and a Y. And to really simplify things, the X chromosome carries a lot of emotion. Women have a double dose of it. The Y chromosome carries with it rational thought. Now, that doesn't mean that women can't have rational thought or men can't be super emotional. It doesn't mean that at all. But what we're trying to do is get back down to the essence of things and try and envision this example. In 1787, it was a group of men who gathered in hot, swampy, insect-infested Philadelphia behind heavily draped windows to the light of tallow candles to craft the Constitution. You would be hard-pressed to envision a group of women doing that same thing under those same conditions. So again, this is not a value judgment. This is about understanding the essence so that if you understand the essence, you can start to define what is really the problem so that you can actually come up with a solution that may actually affect the outcome. So, language, we have propositions. We need the people to understand what they're voting for. You make it so that anybody can say, excuse me, that's illegal because it exceeds the Fleisch-Kincaid test of sixth grade reading. You can't put that on the ballot. Concrete. Yes.
I have thought about the Constitution quite a bit, and I just wanted your thoughts on the fact that the Constitution was written not as rules for the people, but as rules and handcuffs for the government. And in addition to speaking about that, I was wondering if you could speak to what I feel is the case with government, is that they become unreachable by the average person. They put up this stone wall between them and the people to the point where effectively we can't talk to our government anymore.
Thank you. One of the things I plan to do in Sacramento, so I take advantage of the Zoom thing, right? They compel people to go through Zoom. So in Sacramento, what I would be doing in Ventura County is I would be in Ventura County and I would Zoom into Sacramento so that constituents could actually join me in person in meetings, right? So I'll Zoom into Sacramento because I want the people that hired me to be in the meeting with me. Right, so that they can get it firsthand. They're not going to have to hear it from my staff or from me because I need to hear from them. So let me speak to the Constitution. So if you stop to think about it, it's a business. It's the business of this country. And this country has Articles of Association, which is our Declaration of Independence. And we have our bylaws, which is our Constitution. That's basically what it is. So we have constituted this the business of being the nation of the United States of America. And we have agreed that we have a set of our Articles of Association, which is our mission statement, which is our value statement. And that is our Declaration of Independence. And then we have the bylaws, which is how we will behave. Now, all of that is directed to the public interactions because it is presumed when all of this was written that the private activity would be governed by the Judeo-Christian ethos because people were Christian and or Jewish mostly, but they had a common denominator of the Ten Commandments, and I keep going back to that, to the Bible. And as a result, you will take care of your personal stuff personally, but we do need a set of rules for when we come together in public. And so to do that, we need to make very clear what we're going to allow government to do for us and what our responsibility is in holding them to that governance. And it's that second piece that we've lost track of. How do we do that? And you talk about they've become unreachable. Nullification is one way to do it. And I'm sorry, I might have a few of those brochures here about nullifying things, about nullifying legislation. And basically, it's one of those things where if you find, and a judge can do this, individuals can do this, if you find that the law is repugnant to the Ten Commandments, basically, repugnant to mankind, then you have an obligation to not follow it, to not behave according to that precept. So my husband and I, thankfully, during COVID, we were of a like mind from the very beginning. And so we never had a struggle at home in that conversation because we both of us said, no, my body's mine and your body's yours. And together we're a couple and, you know, we're going to meet the world head on. And they're not going to tell us to behave any particular way. We are good people and that's all we need to operate in the world. So, yes, it's a prescription for government. And there's another feature to it, the enumerated rights, which is what they talk about. There's a school of thought out there which the totalitarians have grasped and too many people have allowed them to hold sway, which says that if it's not specifically described, enumerated in the Constitution or the documents, then it's allowed, it's implied that the state can do the work, that the state can get involved in that. When in fact, when you read the Federalist Papers and other founding documents, the enumerated power says, no, no, that's all you can do. You don't get to do anything else. That's it. That's it. And so we have, because we haven't understood it in the kind of muscular way that's necessary to enforce it for the benefit of ourselves and for most people, that we are facing what we're facing now. So this is a huge correction that we've got to do. We've got to put that genie back in the bottle. It's going to be really hard. It's not going to be easy. And I may not see it in my lifetime, but I do know that if I don't act now, that I'm not willing to accept that as the epitaph to my stone whenever that time comes. So is there one more question?
Yeah, thank you. So I get with it a lot with what you're saying with the local, but I do have an issue with Honestly, I just don't see how it's really possible to support Trump in the 2024 election, given that, you know, we all went through 2020. And, you know, I've read a very good Twitter thread / article from Michael P. Singer, who is the author of Snake Oil, which kind of goes into how the Chinese government sort of influenced the worldwide COVID response, basically detailing how Trump was kind of talking on both sides of his mouth in 2020 in terms of like protecting people's rights versus like instituting authoritarian COVID policies. You know, I'm voting for RFK personally because I just think, you know, neither party has really stood up for our rights, you know, during the absolute travesty of, you know, the quote unquote mandates of 2020 and 2021. Yeah, I guess there's some cognitive dissonance for me because I can say, okay, some of the stuff on the Age Agenda 47 stuff might be good, but I can't trust a politician who kind of left us all, you know, especially in the quote unquote liberal states like California, to kind of hang, you know, in this situation.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much. You're not the first person who's commented that to me. Let me first deal with the detail about RFK Jr. If on your ballot you write him in, your ballot will be kicked out and some stranger will have to remake it, because when the machine looks at it, the machine will say somebody's written on this ballot, so we need to figure out what they mean. Because in California, you have to be a qualified write-in, and RFK Jr. is not a qualified write-in for the ballots that are out there right now. So that's one thing, is that I would encourage you to consider either not voting at all, and that I don't know what party you're registered with, or no party preference. If no party preference, you won't have a presidential race on your ballot to vote. So unless in California, the way it's organized, if you are no party preference, then you can turn in your ballot, or you can ask for a Democrat ballot or an American independent ballot or a Libertarian ballot. On the Libertarian ballot, it has James Bradley for president. That's the only one you can vote for president. On the Democrat ballot, it has Joe Biden. That's the only one you can vote for. On the American independent ballot, I've forgotten which one it is, doesn't matter. So the point of it being that the only time that you could vote for Donald Trump is if you are registered as a Republican, because you can't get it without being a registered Republican. That's a whole other conversation. So if you're no party preference, you won't even have a presidential race on your ballot. So that's first thing.
Well, I was thinking in terms of the general, not the primaries.
So in the general election, if we just stop and think about what has happened in the last 3 years about how the world has turned topsy-turvy since COVID first happened, a lot's going to happen this year. We have no idea where November's going to come and where we're going to come out. I don't think that if we approach all of this as though it were any other election year, or a really important election year, but mostly like all other election years, then we may miss some really important signs about what's taking place. So while it may be that is what happens in the November election, and that's what you elect, and he may get on the ballot. I know some people here are talking about helping to collect signatures to make sure that he gets on the ballot and do all of that. So that's fine, whatever it is that you do there. Let me just make this observation. He's a politician too, and he comes from a political family. So when we talk about politicians, we need to make sure that we understand that he has that political patina too, much more so than Donald Trump.
Although Donald Trump's business, I mean, you know, they're all corrupt. They're all rotten.
But although Donald Trump's grandfather, when he was out west pursuing the gold rush, ran for and won a judgeship, right? But that doesn't make Donald Trump a politician. He's a politician now, but he was a businessman all of his life. But the other thing, too, that I would ask you to consider is when Donald Trump was in the White House and COVID came to town, we individually knew, and then some of us who got to know each other during that time collectively understood, that this was government overreach at best. It was attempt for massive control at worst, a yeah. globalist kind of agenda.
Yeah.
So if we knew that in our couple of weeks when COVID first started, March of 2020, if we all knew that come March 30th, 2020, April 15th, 2020, Donald Trump knew that too. But what we don't know is how much more he knew. Because we will never know. We know what we know. And again, this is frame of reference. We know what we know. What we do not know is he probably knew everything that we did, plus, plus. And there's a really excellent book that I recommend to you from Scott Atlas, Dr. Scott Atlas, who was at the table about the COVID development, which was turned over, notice, to Mike Pence. So was this really an attempt to put Pence in the firing line and or see what he did with it? Don't know. Have no idea. But what we don't know is how much more Donald Trump knew. Is it possible? Think of it this way. If Donald Trump, and he did try and come out with this at first, he said, it's just a common cold. You may remember right at the very beginning. All right, so we're going to do 2 weeks to flatten the curve, but don't worry about it. It's not going to be bad, folks. Live your lives. He said that at the very beginning. Is it possible that given the massive machinery that put fear into the minds and hearts of people all over the world, that had Donald Trump tried to stand against that machine at that moment in time, that he might have burned himself out completely?
I'm not willing to make excuses for politicians like that.
Yeah, I'm not. It's not an excuse. It may sound like an excuse to you, but I'm not offering it as an excuse. What I'm offering it as to think to broaden one's thinking. What is it that he might have known that would have made him message the way he did message? That's really the question. And whether if you give yourself permission to think through that thing, you may still come to your same conclusion. That may be true. And that's fine. But at least you will have considered things more deeply and more broadly than just responding, understandably, to an outrage, a righteous kind of outrage. It's like, you want to tell me what to do? You want to get reelected, and yet you were the one who helped bring this on, at least initially you did? And RFK Jr. all this time has been saying no, no, no? Right? So I understand, but I just encourage you to think about, and I encourage you to think about this too. RFK Jr., health, great. Absolutely, we need health. Would RFK Jr., and I don't know what the answer is, but if you close your eyes and you say, I'm imagining RFK Jr. across the table from Xi Jinping. How does that conversation go? If RFK Jr. is the president of the United States, how does that conversation go?
Honestly, I don't think that he'd be any worse than Trump in the table with Xi Jinping. I'm not convinced that Trump has done a better job on foreign policy either.
Okay.
You know, like, my main concern is preventing another 2020, but when I look at them on other issues, I'm not standing here thinking like, oh, I'm going to hold my nose and vote for RFK. Actually, the contrary. So,
no problem. I mean, I understand. There are people that feel that way for sure. And it's not my job. It's not my job to convince you. That's not my job. My job is to put some ideas out there, some thoughts, some tools that you might use. Like, you remember like the Ten Commandments, choosing the one, like the bedtime story or the Aesop's fable or the Bible story. Think about that. Like thinking about, well, what is it that might have done? Is there something that somebody could know that I wouldn't know that might have changed my mind had I known it? That's all. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Deb, very much for coming and speaking with us. I was wondering, before we end this, if you could tell us how we can get involved in your campaign and what websites we need to go to find out about what's going on.
Sure. There's a QR code on the back of this, which gives you a little more information about me. And you can get to my campaign there. You can write to me there. If you're interested in some of these resources that I use to do my research, like Discover the Networks, like the Encyclopedia of Anti-Revisionism, which is a collection of communist documents from throughout the world that you can read about the communist party. They're out there. They've published it for decades. Things of that sort, several books that I'm happy to recommend to you that I'm happy to do that. So you can find me using the QR code on the back of this flyer here, which also gives you a little more information. Again, if you want to help my campaign directly and you want to give a little bit of elbow grease to it, you can make phone calls. You can send emails. My part of my campaign is really about being personal. It's not, I didn't dust off that playbook and say, okay, I'm going to look like this, I'm going to act like this, I'm not going to talk about Trump because you're not supposed to in California. But instead, it's about if you are interested in getting involved and you say, you know what, I think I'd like to make phone calls. Can I try five? I'll give you five. If you say, you know what, I don't really want to talk on the phone, but I'll send some emails. I'll send you everything you need. I'll send you the emails for you to use, and I'll send you the text for you to put in there. Who's your contact again? Yeah, if you contact me through my website, that's the best way to do it. Yep, if you scan this QR code, and the website is votedebbaber.com, votedebbaber.com, and that's on here as well. But if we're ready to close, the one thing I'd love to do is invite everybody to sing along, God Bless America.
Awesome, go for it.
God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night with the light from above. From the mountains to the prairies to the oceans white with foam. God bless America, my home, sweet home. God bless America, my home, sweet home. Thank you.
Thank you, Deb. All right, folks, this concludes our presentation, but we do have an open mic period at the end of all our meetings where you can come up and spout off about anything that you would like to talk about. So feel free to come on up to either one of the microphones and let us know what you've got to say, talk about whatever you want. Events you've got coming up or whatever you would like to. So I'm going to start this off myself. But if you would like to come on up and say something, please line up at one of the mics.
Sure,